failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to this edition, Century of Lies. I am Dean Becker. I want to thank a couple of folks for helping us here at the Mothership meet our pledge goals. I want to thank Houston Normal, Houston Cancer Doctor Richard, and John from Palm Harbor, Florida. With their help, we almost doubled our commitment. Here in just a moment, we're going to bring in our guest, but a bit later, we're going to hear from Oklahoma Senator Connie Johnson, as well as a reporter from the Houston Chronicle, Dane Schiller. I want to read from our guest's book. He's stating in here, we have the need to recognize the extent of substance use and abuse in our society. This is increasing rapidly, and more people require realistic, harm-reduction-oriented help. This is not popular, even an acceptable truism in the United States, despite ample evidence every day that our larger political and public health policies are meaningless or, worse, counterproductive. HAMS, and we'll learn more about that in a minute. HAMS is for the large majority of substance users who have problems, who remain unserved by our current Alice in Wonderland approaches, the often unacknowledged majority. And with that, I want to welcome the author of How to Change Your Drinking, A Harm Reduction Guide to Alcohol. Kenneth Anderson, are you there, sir?
Hello, Dean. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine. Kenneth, I want to thank you for this book. It has some truisms in here that need to be recognized very much so across this country, and I thank you.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Now, in the show we just completed, I was talking about I have now 26 years without a drink. That has worked for me, but in some cases, some people find that it is possible to drink in moderation, but they do need to change their habits, right?
Absolutely. We are a free-of-charge, lay-led support group for people who want to make any positive change in their drinking habits, from safer drinking to reduced drinking to quitting alcohol altogether. What we find is that small steps can lead to big changes, and a lot of people are, you know, they're willing to make some small steps. They don't want to make the big changes right away, but if you can engage people to making small steps, they get encouraged, they want to make more positive changes, and the majority of people will more likely get better going a little at a time than by quitting all at once.
Right, and there is that situation where those in authority demand total abstinence, and therefore when somebody slips up, they are led to feel like they have failed, when the truth may be told, they have made some progress. Your response?
Absolutely. The more traditional and old-fashioned type of treatment programs for alcoholism tended very much to shame people and, you know, very much say, you know, if you have one drink, you lose all your abstinent time and you're back where you started from. And this has been found not to be very productive. It's much better to encourage people and, you know, to praise them for making positive changes. You know, you abstained for a whole week from alcohol. Now you drank one day. Now you can get started again and abstain some more and abstain another week. So you didn't lose that whole week. You know, you just had this little slip-up, so you can keep going.
Yeah, and I have seen over the years, like when I first quit, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous for several months. I don't remember exactly. I don't think I ever got my six-month coin. But the fact of the matter is, I started telling people how I was substituting the use of cannabis for my very excessive drinking, and I was told that that was a no-no, and I wasn't, wanted at those meetings. Your response?
That's very common. Many people have reported it to me that when they have used marijuana as a substitute for alcohol, and they've talked about it at AA meetings, they've gotten very negative responses. They've been told they're not sober. They've been told to leave until they quit the marijuana. But the research actually tells us just the opposite story. Dr. Amanda Ryman at University of California, Berkeley, has published a paper in Harm Reduction Journal in 2009 about studies in cannabis substitutions for alcoholism and other addictions, and it was found to be very successful. She's still doing more ongoing work. Before this, Dr. Todd McCuria, also in California, had studied, he's passed away recently, but he's prescribed for quite a while medical marijuana for people with alcohol dependence and found them very successful at staying away from alcohol when they were able to use the marijuana.
And as I said, it's worked for me for 26 years. Before that, there was car wrecks, there was fights, there was traffic tickets, you know, the list goes on. And since that point in time, none of the above. So I think I have proven that point. Now, let's talk about, here in Chapter 1, you talk about why people overdrink. There are reasons behind that, right?
There are lots of reasons. Many people have anxiety or depression or panic or social phobia, and they actually use alcohol as a coping mechanism. And, you know, at first it works pretty well, and then it starts having more negative consequences, and pretty soon, you know, it starts to turn into a nightmare for them. And so they need to find some way to change their drinking habits. And, you know, some people will quit, some will cut back, some will substitute cannabis.
Well, you know, in my case, I very much believed in the, I don't know, euphemism, whatever, that I think I heard first in the Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, is that I was one of those, when I had a drink, that drink wanted another drink. And the day after I quit, I, you know, automatically went into the convenience store, bought a pack of Marlboros and a tall boy of Coors, and I got in the car and I popped the top and realized, wait a minute, I quit this. And I threw it in the trash. It's not that easy for most folks, is it?
It is not. And I wanted to say one thing. As I said, marijuana substitution, cannabis substitution, is very successful for many people. It's not for everyone. I myself personally have not smoked cannabis in decades because I have bad side effects. So I'm not speaking because I personally want to use cannabis. But there's so many people that I have known that have come to my organization for help. And they say, well, I can't drink anymore. I have liver problems. And, you know, we say, well, cannabis won't hurt your liver. Or they're having withdrawal from alcohol, which can be very dangerous. Alcohol withdrawal can be deadly. And cannabis does not have this kind of withdrawal. There are other people that get in fights in bars when they drink. And, you know, cannabis mellows people out. It doesn't lead them to become aggressive or start fights. So for these people, they find cannabis to be a much better substitute than alcohol, and it keeps them away from a whole myriad of problems that they would otherwise have if they continued with alcohol.
Now, in this book, there are means whereby you can kind of outline your problem. You kind of charts and questionnaires and so forth, where you can kind of picture what your habit is, and then means by which you can begin to change it. Not necessarily pull the plug in one day, but change it, right?
Absolutely. We have many worksheets, and you don't have to do them all. We encourage people to find the element of the program that appeals to them the most and start with that. You don't have to do everything. We don't have steps. We have 17 elements in our program. You can do them in any order. They are all optional. You can just do one, and if it works for you, for example, charting your drinks, writing down the number of drinks that you have each day in terms of standard drinks, measured standard drinks. Some people find this is the only thing they need to do to change their drinking. It works for them, and once they start doing this, you know, they manage, you know, in a short period of time to get their drinking under control. And if that's all you need, that's good. If you need more things, there are many other things there, many other exercises and worksheets that people can use to change their drinking habits.
All right, folks, once again, we're speaking with Mr. Kenneth Anderson. He's author of How to Change Your Drinking, A Harm Reduction Guide to Alcohol. Now, you have set up an organization, HAM. Why don't you tell us what that's about, and maybe how folks could learn more about the work you're doing?
Yes, the acronym HAMS The H is for harm reduction. The A is for abstinence from alcohol. The M is for moderate drinking. And the S is for support, because we are a support group for any positive change, moderate drinking, quitting altogether, abstinence, or being safer, any form of harm reduction. Our website is hamsnetwork.org. We have online support groups. And in particular, I want to mention we have some specialized online support groups, too. We have a marijuana maintenance support group. It's called CATS. It's the Cannabis as Alcoholism Treatment Support Group. And this is a Yahoo group that people can join if they want to talk about substituting marijuana for alcohol. And the place to go on our website, hamsnetwork.org/MM, MM for marijuana maintenance, hamsnetwork.org/MM. It will give you links to our Yahoo group. It will give you links to our Facebook group about cannabis substitution and a lot of information about cannabis substitution on that page.
Okay. Well, Ken, you know, you've got a chart here, alcohol drinking level and risk. You got very high risk for men, 20 drinks a day. Woo. And then alcohol abstinence, of course, is zero, but you list it from healthy drinking, one or two, no risk, maybe three or four, and low risk, five to seven. I was a, you know, one or two beers per hour kind of guy, you know, and never was drunk, never was really sober. But, you know, it was for me, you know, one of the means to escape the addiction written in here is to go off the hard liquor and maybe move to alcohol. But I was never able to drink much scotch or anything else. I would fall out on the floor. But I guess what I'm getting at here is that the risk, the impact on the individual, it varies quite a bit, doesn't it?
It varies a great deal. And, I mean, some people can stop drinking hard liquor and switch over to beer, and that's enough to help them cut down, and that works for them. Other people find that that's not sufficient. Some people have to severely limit their intake. They will say, I will drink one day a week. I will not touch alcohol the other 6 days. This is pretty much my plan. I abstain from alcohol at least 5 or 6 days a week because I just have to. Otherwise, it gets out of control, and, you know, I feel bad. I feel really nasty inside.
Well, I hear you, physically and maybe a little mentally there. I understand. Now, again, we're speaking with Ken Anderson, author of How to Change Your Drinking. Ken, I look here at some of the risk ranking and some of the things that people do to themselves or to others. A couple of them, drunk driving, unsafe sex with strangers, and drunk dialing or even drunk emails, right? And go ahead.
There are many different risky behaviors that people engage in. And one thing harm reduction encourages people to do is to rank their risks, to realize that some harms are much worse than others. Drinking and driving is a really dangerous thing. Even if you don't kill somebody doing that, if you get arrested, I mean, a DUI these days will cost you a fortune. It's really not worth it. So we strongly encourage people to avoid the most risky behaviors, like drinking and driving. If you get drunk and call your friends on the phone, maybe that's not so bad. They might the next day say, well, you were kind of obnoxious on the phone last night. But it's a lower risk. So we encourage people more to concentrate on high-risk behaviors. Of course, if you get drunk and call up your employer on the phone and, you know, tell him what you think of him and it's not too complimentary, that can be very high-risk. So it's different for different people.
Yeah, it is. It is. Ken, you know, I think about, you know, I was listing the things I used to do, the fights, the traffic tickets, the car wrecks. But I think more than anything was the lack of civility towards people I dealt with, especially my family, that one gets where you lose track of what you really care about too often when you're using alcohol, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Ken, we got just about 2 minutes left here, and I want to kind of turn it over to you to tell folks a little bit more about the book. And again, folks, is How to Change Your Drinking, A Harm Reduction Guide to Alcohol. It's written by Mr. Kenneth Anderson. I highly recommend it. Many of us, probably most of us, have a family member who could benefit from this book. Closing thoughts there, Ken.
Well, we published our book in conjunction with Amazon, so we prefer if you buy from Amazon because they will give our organization more money on the book sales if you buy from Amazon.
Well, let's watch. This is Pacifica, so that's enough there. But you can get it on Amazon. And how to change your drinking. Is there, again, a website you'd like to recommend?
Yes, our website is hamsnetwork.org.
Okay. Well, Ken Anderson, I appreciate you being with us. We're going to wrap it up there. I think it's a book that should be read. And as I said, drinking impacts nearly every family in America. It's something we need to get a better handle on. Mr. Kenneth Anderson, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We are the plant police. With each arrest, we bring peace. We fight eternal war so you can never score. Yes, we are the plant police.
You know, it didn't get a lot of national attention, but there's been a story breaking in Oklahoma where a gentleman who was busted for drugs some 17 years ago has had his parole board look at his sentence, his life without parole sentence. Oklahoma Senator Constance Johnson had a say to that parole board as well. And, ma'am, if you will, please tell the audience what's going on with this gentleman, Larry Yarbrough, his situation before the parole board.
Yes, Mr. Yarbrough, his case came before the board. One of the board members who had been on there previously when he received a unanimous commutation in 2002 was reappointed and brought him up again and had the hearing on this past Wednesday, August the 17th, at the Hillside Correctional Facility in Oklahoma City. We have been promoting a letter-writing campaign to the board and the governor, urging them to commute this sentence, urging them to exercise their power as a board to commute the sentence. And we were successful. They commuted the sentence to 42 years, which essentially means that he will no longer be in prison for life for a crime that he committed 17 years ago involving 3 marijuana joints and an ounce of cocaine. He has served 17 years, has been a model prisoner, has, even after the disappointment of getting unanimously approved in 2002 and turned down by the governor, he still turned his time of incarceration into a time of giving back and serving others. He has trained guide dogs for people who are disabled. He's hosted a variety of fundraisers for domestic abuse for women in domestic violence shelters, and just generally been a person who has given back in spite of his own situation. So his case for me was just very, very timely because I had offered legislation in 2009 that never got a hearing in the Oklahoma State Senate on exactly what happened. My legislation would have required the Pardon and Parole Board to not only review his but 47 other cases of life without parole for drug crimes in Oklahoma. It would have then eliminated that sentence off of the books, and definitely because at this point in our state's circumstances, we are facing budget crisis, and here we are spending on average $23,000 a year to lock up 48 people for many times something that's, other people are getting sentences that will allow them to be paroled. So there's the issue of unfairness of this sentence, but the biggest issue that we're looking at is the cost to Oklahoma of continuing to sentence people and to continuing to maintain the 48 people who've already been sentenced.
Senator Johnson, the courage that you show in just speaking these rather obvious truths is resonating a bit in Oklahoma and around this country, that it's time to rethink some of these laws that were crafted decades ago and to determine their relevance to our modern era, correct?
Yes, that is exactly what we're talking about. And the process for bringing about that change is definitely in the hands of the people at this point. And like I said, the bills I proposed on this prior years have never been heard. So we have reintroduced that concept this year in Senate Bill 986. And Larry Yarbrough's case just happens to be a good send-off for us for this advocacy drive that we're going to be pushing to get the legislature to actually take action on this this policy change. Yeah, it's time. It's costing too much, and it's only going to cost more. We know that people who are incarcerated likely have relatives who are incarcerated. It becomes generational. And in Larry Yarbrough's case, it was definitely the way it was headed. He's got a son who's in prison, and he's got a grandson who's in the pipeline. So all we can see in the future is that these costs are going to continue to accrue because we have these antiquated laws that were really put into effect in, as a way of demonizing what we feel is a problem with addiction in Oklahoma. We have, of the 10 cases that I heard that day sitting listening to the Pardon and Parole Board proceedings, 8 of them were drug-related. But again, none of the drug sentences carried a life sentence like Mr. Yarbrough's. So, like I said, his case was the poster child case for the legislation that we're hoping to get through the system, through the process in Oklahoma this time.
Well, Senator Johnson, I want to thank you for taking time to speak with us. I'll share this with my audience. Is there a website where folks might learn more about this or anywhere you would like to point folks?
What we do want people doing right now is writing to the governor of the state of Oklahoma a letter saying, please accept the board's recommendation to commute Larry Yarbrough's life without parole sentence to 42 years. That's a simple statement. At this point, we're trying to get 10,000 letters going to the governor of the state of Oklahoma to, again, demonstrate the people's power in determining these kinds of policy issues. So just address the letter to Governor Mary Fallon, Oklahoma State Capitol, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, 73105. And we want 10,000 letters in there.
Senator Johnson, I will do my part to, let folks know and encourage them to do as well, to write that letter as well. And I want to just, again, stress the point that there have been so few elected officials willing to touch this so-called third rail. And I thank you for having done so.
I'm blessed to have the opportunity. It's a whole coalition of people way beyond me who are making this thing. It's kind of like the stars have all lined up in this moment, and this is for Larry Yarbrough, but this is for our state and country. So I'm blessed to be able to be a part, and thank you so much.
Criminals get so emboldened, ripped you off thinking you're holding. Can't tell the policeman what you know. Got no recourse to the law. Bad guys duct tape and beat you. They're just looking for that easy score. They will rob, rape, and kill you. Because we got no recourse to the law.
So I woke up this morning. I check out the Houston Chronicle like I always do. And I see a bold headline, Cartels Lure South Texas Officers to the Dark Side. It's written by the Chronicle's Dane Schiller. And here to tell us a little bit more about that is Mr. Dane Schiller himself. Well, what's this about, Dane?
What we've got here is lawman after lawman after lawman selling his badge and going to prison for a real long time. It seems that we've heard about this going on in Mexico for a long, long time and in the United States, but we've got a spike, I guess you'd call it.
Dane, the 9 charged or in prison over drugs or guns in the past 16 months, that's kind of the subheading of the story. Let's talk about those 9. Who are they?
Well, we've got police officers, sheriff's deputies, constables, all of them concentrated in the area between Laredo and Brownsville down there on the southernmost tip of Texas and Mexico. And you've got some of them were pulled in by family members. One in particular comes from a law enforcement family, and he did some of pulling some of the others into the darkness. You've got men that have used their patrol cars to escort loads of cocaine across cities. They've used computers to check databases to find law enforcement vehicles. They've used their connections to try and get military-style weapons to sell into Mexico. They've used their radios to track the movements of other law enforcement personnel to keep loads clear. It seems like you name it, they've done it. They've used their badges, their cars, their uniforms, their contacts to help the traffickers.
No, Dane, this is, you know, it's a stain on the reputation of law enforcement. This is not just in South Texas. This has happened in Houston on occasion. We've had HPD officers in uniform in driving their patrol car, hauling loads of drugs across town. What can be done, do you think, or will something be done to stop this corruption?
I've heard repeatedly from law enforcement officers, as you point out, all over the state, as long as there's the drugs and the money, this is going to continue. There's no way to stop it. Now, in practical terms, what can you do when you've got your police force? They say they can do better background checks on hiring. They can see who people are related to. They can require polygraph exams. They can require follow-up polygraph exams, regular polygraph exams, that sort of thing. But when it comes down to it, they say they've got to do a you know, most law enforcement officers, obviously, are not dirty. But they say they've got to do perhaps a better job in some instances of finding people with the right character, because at the end of the day, it's up to that person to make the decision what they want to do. And no amount of checks and balances can stop them if they've got the desire to go to that side of things.
Yeah, and the dark side, indeed. 40,000 dead, some say, in Mexico because of this policy. We've been speaking with Mr. Dane Schiller of the Houston Chronicle. Dane, any other comments you'd like to make?
I'd just like to say that it struck me as I was going through these cases and talking to people involved in these cases how, for instance, here we've got nine men that had pretty decent jobs, pretty decent careers. They are respected in their communities, it seems, and they got greedy, a little greedy, a lot greedy, and now they're looking at 6, 7, 10, 20, 30 years in federal prison without the possibility of parole. And you've got to ask yourself, what is all this about? Was any of it worth it? Where is it headed?
All right. I want to thank Dane Schiller and all the good folks at the Chronicle. They get it. They're one of the most anti-prohibitionist newspapers in the country, if not the world these days. Let's talk about what gives the drug war life. You know, it is fear, and fear could make this drug war last forever. You know, why all the fear? What's the purpose of the fear? I think most of you folks are smart enough to know that it's multifaceted, but it's mostly for control of the people. When you are afraid, you're willing to look at Big Brother for help, and in return, you're willing to give more taxes for a good plan, more of your liberty if you're assured is for a good reason. Well, we've gotten our money's worth out of 20 years of Miami Vice reruns and movies like Scarface, Traffic, and Training Day. We've been inundated with now highly discredited stories of PCP users stronger than Godzilla, crack babies with no possible future, pot smokers that support terrorism. A couple of years back, the U.S. government was found to be involved in writing the scripts for certain television programs to showcase their anti-drug messages. The government is certainly involved in everything the press will let them get away with, in demonizing drug reformers like me, discrediting valid scientific studies that disprove government hype, and in making up new lies to cover the the holes in their previous lies. Reality is what's really at stake here. It starts with marijuana. It goes right up to the newest part of the drug war, the war of terror. And, you know, guys, there's no justification for this. Please visit our website, which is endprohibition.org. Prohibido es, Doc Ivalesco.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.